gives me especially great pleasure, and I will explain why in a little while, to introduce today our speaker, Dr. Igor Pilchikov, who comes to us from Tallinn, Estonia, although I think the announcement says that he is also a lead researcher at the Institute for World Culture at Lomonosov State University in Moscow, which is true. He's also a senior researcher in the Estonian Institute for Humanities at Tallinn. He apparently does one of those jobs long distance, which happens these days. The reasons for me to be sentimental about introducing Igor is that he's certainly the person I know the longest in this room. We met first in 1986 as undergraduate students at the University of Tartu. We graduated with our bachelor's degrees from that school the same year, 1991. And we haven't met since late 90s. So meeting Igor at least 15 years after our last meeting was very interesting. Our interests as scholars are very different, and it's the reason why also going over Igor's CV was an especially interesting experience for me preparing to introduce him. So his research interests, his main area of research since his undergraduate career is in Russian Romanticism. And in particular, he is probably one of a handful of specialists in Russian Romantic poetry and in the ways Russian Romantic tradition emulated European Romantic tradition, and not only Romantic, European tradition in general. The three poets in particular are the focus of his attention in many of his articles and in a couple of his books. There's Baratynsky, Batyushkov, and Pushkin. For those of you who are not Russianists, probably only Pushkin rings the bell, but the other two are also very important Romantic poets in Russian tradition. His first book was on Batyushkov and Italian literature. His second book, which some of the people in this room certainly made use of when teaching Pushkin, as Lexicon and Phraseology in Eugene Onegin. It came out in 2008 in Moscow. The first one came out in 2003. But this is not the only area of Igor's interest. His other area of interest in which he published extensively is Russian versification in relation to the Romantic period, but not only. Comparative versification, when it comes to German, French, Italian sources from which Russian poets borrowed, and Russian. So here's yet another area of interest is translation, in which he also practiced, and elements of theory of translation are embedded in his research because he's dealing constantly with this cultural translation of certain European sources. I also wanted to mention in this room that Igor was involved as a translator in translation of a major piece in Russian history by Richard Wortmann, which is called Scenarios of Power. It's a two-volume, like War and Peace kind of study on the history of Russian monarchy. So he single-handedly translated one of the volumes and edited the translation of the second one, of the first one. And alongside all those interests, Igor, late in the 90s, from what I understand, developed interest in digital humanities. And he was a founding editor-in-chief of two major online digital libraries of classical Russian literature. One is called Russian Virtual Library, another Fundamental Electronic Library of Russian Literature and Folklore. He's also interested in an issue of new research tools that become available to scholars as the sources with which we deal become digitized. And I think this is what he will be talking today mostly. And for that, I want to give the floor to you.
Thank you very much for your generous introduction. I'll try to speak about a few resources devoted to the study of Russian literature, and primarily Russian classical literature, not only classical literature, and I will concentrate on the projects in which I took part myself, either as a founding member of the team or as an active participant in one or another part of the projects I'm going to speak about. So we definitely don't have enough time to discuss all the developments in digital humanities related to Russian literature, but I'll try to concentrate on what seems most important to me. Well, before I start talking about the collections, the tools, I just wanted to say a couple of words on the problems of information search in Russian using big search engines, because what we've got in smaller systems is a kind of complement to what we can do with big search engines like Google, Yandex, and so on. So as you perfectly know, Russian is an inflected language, so there are lots of forms, there are different inflections, conjugations, and so on and so on. So if you look for something like the word Billy, you've got the word Billy. You can have now all kinds of encyclopedic information, but what is more important is that this word, as you know, has many other forms: Billy, Billamo, Billo, Billo, and so on and so on. Right? The search in Russian is lemmatized, so you've got all the word forms unified in under the particular vocabulary or lexeme, so that if you your search query includes a word in a particular form, for instance in genitive singular, the result is that you get all other forms of this word, which makes our life easier, because if you have to look for the verbal forms like, you know, шел, идти, идущий, подошедший, and so on, you will have to type all the forms in order to get information. In case if you need not the entire paradigm but only one form, of course you can use special queries and something like quotation marks, so that you've got only the it should actually. The problem is that big engines often change their rules, and very often do not tell us about the change. So what we used yesterday, did not and doesn't work today. So let me see if I try this. No. So.
But it is in the text.
So it's okay, yeah. Ah, so it still works. That's great. So this is one problem. Another problem is that Russian language exists in several orthographies, several spellings. There are differences between the spelling before 1956 and after 1956, but the most important borderline is 1918, when the spelling reform took place and several letters were eliminated from the alphabet. Also, the spelling of some morphemes changed. For instance, the Ogo morpheme is a new one. The older spelling of this same ending was Ago. or Yago. So what happens if you use the old spelling? Because part of the texts available in electronic form are texts in pre-revolutionary orthography. So if you try to use Google or Yandex, you will have the search results in pre-revolutionary spelling as well. But the results will be different in different search systems. So if you ask Google for BLE spelled in pre-revolutionary spelling with YAT, so this second letter is the old letter, which became coincided with yeah, in Russian and with E in Ukrainian. So the result is the old spelling forms in the texts. If you ask Yandex to do the same, you can see that it gives all the results, both in pre-revolutionary and a modern spelling. So what is used in Yandex is a special algorithm which reduces the differences between the old and modern spelling to well, one unified system. You can actually build your search query in any spelling, and the result is in all other available spellings, so all versions of pre-revolutionary and post-revolutionary spelling. This feature of Yandex is well known to me because it was first commissioned by FabWeb, a project of which I will talk a little bit later. We were among the first groups who started publishing in electronic form, publishing texts in pre-revolutionary orthography, and we wanted to use the possibilities of lexical search, which was not available then in the early, in the first years of the new millennium. So we commissioned this type of search to Yandex, and at the same time, it's now much easier to type the different letters using either keyboard or other devices, and it was quite difficult to do that 15 years ago. So we decided that it would be very complicated, very hard for our users to type queries in pre-revolutionary orthography. So our decision was that any type of orthography can be used for building a query. So Yandex programmed this algorithm for us, and it was invented by Alexey Polyakov, who is also known as a member of FabWeb team and of the National Corpus team. And a couple of months later, Yandex decided that, well, this algorithm is quite good for everybody else, and started using it in the big Yandex. As regards Google, for a short period of time, they also used a similar algorithm, looking for both versions of spelling. But now we can see that with the search result corresponds to your search query, but it's not the same in Google Books, which has a great collection, big collection of Russian books, including pre-revolutionary Russian books, and they have got two main disadvantages. So the main problem of Google Books is that it's not properly a digital library, actually. So this is a kind of experimental field for various Google search queries, and one of the problems with Google Books is widely discussed in American academia. This is the fact that the books are not properly identified in relation to their printed sources in what you you never know precisely what you get, because the description may very vaguely respond to what it describes. Another problem is the books with different alphabets in different languages, and especially different spellings of the same language, for example, Armenian or Russian. So when Google Books started to digitize old Russian books, apparently they did not know that there are at least two different Russian alphabets, the pre-revolutionary and post-revolutionary. So the big part of books are optically recognized, or CR, using the modern Russian language. So the result is what you can see there, the letters which are not available from the modern Russian spelling are either not recognized or recognized as different letters. So this strange query, which is soft sign instead of yet, also gives you about 3,000 results with one word only. But at the same time, what happened next? Google Books realized that there are at least two Russian alphabets and two Russian languages, right, modern Russian and pre-revolutionary Russian, so that another part of these books were recognized using the old Russian spelling for old Russian books and new Russian spelling for new Russian books. But that's not all, because when they saw what happens with Yandex, and it happened, I think, a couple of months after Yandex introduced our algorithm for the search in old spelling, they used the same in the Google Books project as well, so that you can ask for a new form, but you've got the results which include both new and old forms. So let me try to do this. If I want this belly with yeast, and if I want only the books published in the 19th century, and I don't want translations. Okay. Well, so what we can see here, the recognized level is Bielogo, right? If we open the image, it's still Bielogo. No, that's not what I wanted to find. Okay. Let me try this. Right. So this is Bielogo with yet in the image, but barely with yeast in modern form, right, in the OCR text, right? So this is how the search result of this type is made. Well, the problem is that when you build your query, you will never know which of these types of OCR is used in the particular text which may correspond to your query, right? And you have to invent different types of distortions which could take place when you use Google Books as a digital library. Also, you can see that the same mixture can take place even within one book. So this video with yet is OCR with yet, which is not recognized. And the second yet is recognized as a letter corresponding to the modern year. So, well, all this means that
Theta is not recognized.
No. Well, there are, so it is a problem. So you will never know what happens. Nikita Vash is also N plus E. So you, if you want to work with this collection properly, first of all, you should know all types of distortions in the bibliographical annotations and all types of distortions used in the OCR methods. If you can dig like this, you become a real Google Books digger, and you can get something from this useful source, which is not, however, philologically correct or scientifically correct source, as we would say, because in Russia we speak of the science of language and science of literature. And I even formulated well, a principle on which you can say that this particular resource is scientific and that one is not, even maybe it is good in all other directions. If you if you ask something using if you ask a question using Google Books and you get an answer, that's good. If you don't get an answer, if the answer is no, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that what you ask about does not exist. It may exist, but for various reasons, including the ones I told you about, you don't get this result. But in real science, the negative result is also a valuable result. If a negative result is not a valuable result, it's nothing, then this is not a properly scientific search system. So Google Books is a useful pile of books, extra or hyper pile or whatever, but it's not a digital library from the point of view of these two things: identification of information and the unity of its presentation, right? Because of the different types of optical character recognition used on the same corpus of texts. What lays behind these search engines? How is lemmatized search possible? All the systems are built on one and the same grammatical source, which is the grammatical dictionary of the Russian language, compiled by the great Russian linguist Andrei Zeliznyak. And Zeliznyak's dictionary has existed for a long time in digital form. And in principle, this is the only grammatical dictionary of modern Russian language on which every search system is built. Now we've got various modules which are dictionaries which are serve as an addition to Zeliznyak's dictionary, important thing for those who study the literature of the 18th and 19th centuries, Natalia Yeskova's big dictionary of the forms paradigms, which are not available in Zeliznyak. But for most purposes, what we use is the electronic form of this particular dictionary. It's interesting that Zeliznyak gives not only the formal description of all paradigms of all Russian words, but also the accental paradigms. So its information is available from the dictionary, but it's not used in big search systems. However, it is possible to use the same dictionary to mark up poetic texts, because Russian language is language with where stress shifts. So we cannot use easy algorithms like in German, where we expect a stress on a particular syllable. We have to know the morphological type of the word if we want to know where the stress is. So Zeliznyak described all the linguistic paradigms of the Russian world so that they include the stress as well. And this gives us a possibility of accental markup, which is used in projects like the poetic corpus of the national corpus of Russian language. So one of the first analyzers which used the grammatical dictionary was Sergei Starostin's morphological analyzer, which is still available on his site. Starostin was another great Russian linguist who died in 2005. He is famous for the Etymological Database Project based in Moscow and Santa Fe, but he was also one of the pioneers of computational linguistics, and this simple analyzer was built in 1994. It still works, and you can see what lays behind our queries, which I showed you. If you enter something like, I used Poly here, the analyzer realizes that this is either the form of the verb polить or the form of the noun поле, and builds the entire paradigm of these two forms: полью, польёшь, польёт, полило, полило, and so on. You can see that this analyzer uses the information about the stress. And what actually happens when you ask Google or Yandex to look for one form, it looks for all the forms in this particular list, right? It also means that, well, it can be also also a noun, and all the nominal forms are also found here. So if you want to reduce the reduce informational noise, and you don't want the forms of поле when you look for полить, you can find one particular verbal form which belongs to only one paradigm, not two paradigms, and then you've got the results related to one lexeme only. So this is one of the many simple tricks which can facilitate our work with Russian morphology. So what is also interesting about these analyzers, and they are all built on the same principle, is that they don't only use the words that they know, but build other paradigms on the basis of analogy. It means that if you introduce a word which is not available from Zeleznyak's dictionary, it will be still recognized as a word of a Russian language with a particular paradigm. So what I did, I used the word shamaton. It's a very rare word, although it's found, for instance, in Pushkin, in Captain's Daughter. Nobody knows what it means, because it's an obscure word with an obscure etymology. So it is not included in Zeleznyak's dictionary, but if you ask the analyzer to analyze it, it understands that it is a word like filieton, and it belongs to this particular paradigm, and it even knows how to stress it, right? So, well, this is what lays behind the lexical search in all other projects I will describe, including the Fundamental Digital Library and the National Corpus of the Russian Language. So what is used there are different modifications of Yandex search system, which uses one of the analyzers built on Zeleznyak's dictionary. So historically, these three projects are connected to each other. In particular, FebWeb, before it was posted to World Wide Web in the year 2002, existed as a project of Russian classical literature on CDs, and the project started in mid-1990s. Well, I joined it in the year 2000, a year after the Russian Virtual Library was opened on the web. So the first version of Yandex search engine, not for for the web but for CDs, was actually built for the Griboyedov section of FebWeb, or exactly of what was to become the Griboyedov section of FebWeb. At that time, the future FebWeb team and the future Yandex team were just two groups of, I think, four people each, sitting in two small rooms somewhere in the south of Moscow, Varshavskaya. So they know each other from the very beginning, and this is the answer to the question why we commissioned various tools to Yandex, and why Yandex used many of our tools in big Yandex. So the same happened with the National Corpus of the Russian Language, which was first created by Yandex specialists to be used as a kind of experimental field for their search queries, but was very soon developed in, by the linguists from the Institutes of the Academy of Sciences in what it is now. So back to to Feb. Well, I never use the English version of FebWeb because we don't have enough fonts and it hasn't been updated since 2007. But it is a useful draft which can help you to work with, to familiarize with how FebWeb is done, because there are those parts which are available in the English language version are fully functional, and all the descriptions and annotations and so on are available in English here. So if you want to familiarize yourself with FebWeb, then use the English version. If not, you should rather use the Russian version. So two main important features of FebWeb are, first of all, that unlike traditional libraries, which operate with books, with editions, we operate with titles, with works, what we can say, произведения. A book consists of articles or of poems. It can be a very short article, or it can be a long novel, it can be a long poem, or a two-line poem. Each of them is a separate title, a work. Normally in a traditional library you don't have titles, although you can have something like a catalog of journal articles, but this is rather an exception. So normally you look for a book and then you work with what is within the book using other tools like bibliographies. So in FebWeb we work with titles, so it means that every book is split into particular titles, and at the same time the structure of the book is also reproduced in this tree-like system. Why? Because the structure of the book is important. When you open the book, you've got column titles which show that this is section one, this is section two, these are comments, these are bibliographies, and so on. If you reproduce a book as one big sheet, you don't have these important, semantically important portions. So, well, that's why we reproduce the structure of the book. Also, both the entire book and all its parts, all the works found in it, are properly identified in terms of bibliography. They have got the manually edited, automatically generated, but manually edited bibliographical descriptions. Right. Also, the all the what we call digital scholarly editions of InfoWeb have the same structure. If you come to the Pushkin section or say the Lermontov section, you can find one and the same type of structure. You've got encyclopedia entries, you've got various editions of the works, normally more than one. For instance, in Lermontov you've got five different editions. You've got Lermontov secondary literature. In Pushkin, you've got both secondary literature and serials, and so on and so on. What are the shortcomings of FebWeb? Shortcoming number one is the dark side of what is its advantage. Work with titles. It means that you can have an entire book like this, or you can have a title. And if you need a quotation, you can use search. In search, you can build a query like words or word expressions. You can also search by authors, and you've got a list of all authors available in the edition. So you can have all the works of Azadovsky, for instance, about Lermontov, not much. At the same time, you can look for a word, I don't know, and look for this word only in one author, for instance. So the result is all the uses of this verb in Lermontov, something which you cannot do using the external search system. So you can search for a verb using Google, cite for a verb, but you cannot use the metadata of this type. And we can use this metadata because they are split into titles, right? At least author, title, and date of publication is always used. But if you are given a reference of the type Complete Works, Volume 6, page 32, then it is a problem, because if you start looking for page 33 in this book, we don't know in which title it is. And you can browse only the work, not the entire edition. So you have to click it title by title to see where page 33 is. Aha, it's in this particular title. So this makes life complicated, because if you open a volume of Pushkin, where there are lots of short lyrical poems, then you have to click a lot. Another problem of FabWeb is that we can reproduce the modern Russian text, the old Russian text, but at the same time, there are things which are or were too hard to reproduce as text, and we reproduced it as images. For instance, the collection of the Bulletin of the Academy of Sciences from the very first volumes of 1852. So they are reproduced as image only, and this version one, as we call it, consists of two parts: texts and images. Right? Images are facsimile but not searchable, and texts are in rich format, so they give you an idea how they look like in the original, but they are not facsimiles. So we decided to overcome these two shortcomings, and we have worked for several years on the project which we call FabWeb version 2, of which we now have got a working model, a better version. Let me see. Here it is. So this looks like the old FabWeb, but it works with images on which we have got the projection of text. So we can search the text and can have the images the same as you can have in Google books. At the same time, we developed the indexes sections, so they are better developed here. And what happens? For instance, I find something like Dal, and using the search as an old FabWeb or these indexes, can look for Dal, and what I get as a result is this. So this is the image, the facsimile image, under which we've got the OCR text. And the results of the query are projected onto the image. So it works like what we could see on Google Books, but we have preserved all the positive features of FabWeb. First of all, we got all the descriptions of the edition. We've got the structure of the edition here. But if the old FabWeb consists of HTML files, representing each particular title, and they are structured as a book, which makes our life difficult. So these new files are actually XML files with internal structure, so that you can browse this book as a book, right, wherever you want. You can have the image, and you can also search it as a text. So this is what FabWeb should become. The problem is how to move from the old version into the new version. The same problem existed in the digital service of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, which is called Gallica, and which consisted from images and texts at the beginning, and now they moved from the text, this heterogeneous type of library, to what I'm trying to present here. It took them about 8 years and a budget which is approximately 100 times as high as the budget of FabWeb in its best years. So it's not a very good prospect. So if we have the same type of organization of digital humanities in Russia, it would take us about 2 centuries to move from Feb 1.1 to FabWeb 2. So the Russian National Corpus is a different system with different aims and tasks. So don't use its English language interface. If you want to use it properly, you can only use it to familiarize yourself with the corpus. Or otherwise, you need the Russian language interface. So the National Corpus of Russian Language consists of different queries. In FabWeb, you can search for authors or for words, or words plus authors, or words plus titles, and so on. In the Russian National Corpus, you can search for words, for word forms, or for particular grammatical features. Also, it is important that it consists of several corpora. One big corpus in which all types of texts are found, but also a dialect corpus or poetic corpus where poetic texts are found, syntactic corpus, and so on. And these corpus have additional markup which you can use for your specific queries. I like poetic corpus because I study poetry. So what I already tried to do here is, I looked for the word nihilist. Right, and then you can see that it is used in 300 documents found in this corpus. There, the search results are normally represented in the reverse chronological order. So the latest is Daniil Granin's Zubr. Well, you can have two things: statistics and distribution by years. Statistics is this one. So you can see that this word is most often used by Saltykov-Shchedrin, which is one result. Then Liskov, the author of the celebrated anti-nihilist novel, The Najah, right? But you can see that Turgenev, is not even in the first top 10. The top 10, right? At the same time, you can see how the frequency distribution. So the 1860s, 65, and 70s, this is the period when the anti-nihilist novel flourished, so it's not a surprise that you've got a peak here. A surprise is the use of nihilism in the first decade of this century, this millennium. And this is already question why. So maybe it's just a coincidence, but maybe there is a particular reason. So using such a simple query, you can get an answer which is meaningful. We understand why, how to explain the first peak, although if we don't know anything about the existence of the anti-nihilist novel, this is a pretext to think about it, why authors in this particular period used it so often. Right. As far as the poetic corpus is concerned, what you can have here is not only the search for words, but also for various metrical parameters, like meter, like types of verse ending, like strophes, stanzas, and so on and so on. So you can look for all iambic texts, or all iambic tetrameters, or whatever you want. For instance, we can look for all hexametric texts in Russian poetry, and so here we are. The latest hexametric text seems to be Arseny Tarkovsky. You can always get to the full text here. So the poetic corpus has got poetry from the 18th to the late 20th century, and sometimes the 18th century is even better represented in the National Corpus than 19th century. The reason is that the corpus of the 18th century text was borrowed by and remarked up by the National Corpora from the Russian Virtual Library, and we were the first to produce the substantial corpus of 18th century poets. So we can see that there are lots of 18th century authors there. But we used, again, different markup and different ideas. So in all the libraries, there are all the sources, there are, you know, some specific aims for which the texts are marked up and presented. So this library is one of the first philological, as we call it, resources on the Russian web. It was opened in 1999, whereas the web domain for Russia .ru was launched on in 1994. So it's a very long period of existence for a digital library. So the main difference between FEB and Der Weber, although they are closely related projects, not only me, it's not only me who is the member of both projects, is that FEBWeb is based on several important names and lots of information about one important name, right? Many editions of Lermontov, lots of literature on Lermontov and so on. Der Weber represents, well, it develops not intensively but extensively. So we've got plenty of authors, including authors in anthologies. There are other tools which are available on Der Weber but not available on FEBWeb. For instance, we've got the indexes of verse forms. For many authors, and non-lemmatized concordances, indexes of word forms. So, well, for instance, this is for Bogdanovich. Looks like this. So we can see which words are used there. But this is the index of word forms, not lexemes. And there are other resources, in particular, found on FEBWeb, which are actually the lemmatized concordances. The first such concordance was created by Alexei Polyakov, and this is a Griboyedov concordance. It's called Slovarizika Griboyedov. This is a complete concordance to all the texts of Griboyedov with a possibility to go to the full texts. And the concordance on which we work now is the concordance to the poetic text of Lomonosov. This is a complicated thing because there are lots of unusual paradigms in Lomonosov. In modern Russian we have got words like Vostok, which is east, but in Lomonosov it's Vostok, 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 and so on. So we have to adjust the morphological part of the analyzer, and Polyakov developed morphological analyzer, which analyzes different types of Russian spellings systems. Also, we introduced elements of a dictionary in this concordance. So, if you've got the word like I don't know, like niebo, you actually have different homonyms under different sections. So, this is not a dictionary, but there are elements of dictionary here because you've got different homonyms separated from each other. And also, we tried to overcome the disadvantage of all Russian all Russian dictionaries of the language of poetry or of literature, namely the absence of proper names. In Russian tradition, lexicology does not embrace proper names because proper names are covered by encyclopedias and normal words by dictionaries. But in artistic language, both proper names and non-proper names are important. For instance, Lomonosov wrote a letter, a poem about Peter the Great, and we can see that there is a name Narishkin used there, but there are actually three different Narishkins. So to differentiate between these Narishkins, we have to add the meta-information of encyclopedic type, not lexicographical type. We don't have much time now, I have to finish. So there are other important reference tools such as Yandex Story project, which is unfortunately dying because they don't support it anymore. This section was created by FebWeb team. They're using the same principles as we're using Feb, but adjusted to the Yandex search. There were lots of interesting dictionaries there, but Yandex does not update the copyright for dictionaries. So each year you've got less and less dictionaries as compared with previous dictionary. With the exception of the English, Russian, French, Russian, German, Russian, and so on dictionary. This part is created by another important IT corporation in Russia, ABBY. This is the set of ABBY lingua dictionaries. For instance, French, Russian dictionary is the digital version of well-known printed edition of Sherba Matusevich, and the English-Russian dictionary is a bilingual own and very good dictionary. So what can we look for? I don't know which word. Right, so we can search both the English part and the Russian part. We can use other dictionaries as well. So this is a very useful tool. The online version, you can see that there are more than one dictionary for each language. So there are at least 25 dictionaries for English, and you can search all dictionaries at the same time. Well, the last thing I can tell you about now are the parallel corpora of Russian and non-Russian text, in particular Russian English and Russian French corpora. They are available both on the Rus Corpora, the national corpus, as a one of subcorpora, and there are independent parallel corpora as well. So what we can do here is to use the same thing, like, well, I searched for Nihilist and found it in Tolstoy's Anna Karenina and Turgenev's Novy. But here in parallel corpora, you've got both the Russian text and the available translations, and each portion, each segment of the Russian text is parallel to the translation. So it's a very useful tool for the students of translation and the students of the language. So you can see how the texts or the words or expressions, phrases you are interested in were translated by your predecessors. So I think that's almost everything I wanted to talk about. Well, this is the last interesting portion. We talked about the problems of Google Books. The books are not properly identified. So what people do, they collect books from Google Books and identify them and put them in one particular place. So this is what historic students of history started to do. Then they were joined by archaeologists, geographers, philologists, and so on. And this nice site is just a Russian section of Google Books run by a few enthusiasts, where you can find the pre-revolutionary books. They are in public domain, but they are found in one particular place, for instance, all Russian periodicals, all the Vestnik Europa, and so on and so on. So it's much easier to find it here than to find it on Google Books, because on Google Books, Vestnik Europa is annotated in a few different ways. Some of the bibliographical annotations use Yat, and Vestnik is with Yat. Others are modernized, and you cannot actually find this attribute search tool in Google Books, so that you are unable to find all the Vestnik Europa editions within Google Books. And here you've got all of them, and it's much easier to get. Although these PDFs are not OCR, so you can have only images, but either this or that. So I think that I have eaten all my time. Thank you for your attention.
Here that we are eternally in your presence, and You'll be a huge fan.
Thank you.
Many of us make extensive use of Fed in every way. I guess my question is, what do you see the future of digital humanities, particularly these projects, like what's the future in the next, say, 5-10 years?
Right.
Or 200.
Right. So there are two aspects, theoretical and practical. So theoretical is that, well, we need new tools and new corpora, and we can use the already digitized materials to add new markup and to build new corpora. Why we need new corpora? Because we got more tasks than those tasks which are facilitated by projects like FEB or Roscorpora. For instance, neither linguistic corpora nor digital libraries can be effectively used for lexicographers, especially for the so-called author's lexicography or poetic lexicography. If you want to build compile a dictionary of Turgenev's language, we cannot use either RVB or national corpus because we don't have all the variants of the text with proper dates. What we normally have got in critical editions, for instance, is the very last wording or version or redaction of the text and the date of the earliest version. But there are many authors, like I was given an example of Zhukovsky, who reworked his poems written in the 1810s until 1840s, and this is the period when the language changed drastically. So the difference between the 1840s and 1810s is more or less the same as the distance between 1940s and 1910s. So two different epochs with two different languages, and many forms simply appeared and came to existence later than the 1810s. So if you try to use these editions, you will be always wrong. The first fixation of the world will be lost, and so on and so forth. Also, in the national corpus, you've got only one version of the same text. In digital libraries, you've got many versions, but they are like books in the library. You've got the critical publication and the warden section, and so on. Then you have to guess which is which, and then you work with these texts as if you work with traditional texts. You cannot use any automated harvesting of these wordings. If you want to compile a proper dictionary, you need a different type of a corpus. So this is our first interesting task. Another task is use of additional and more subtle parameters for meter recognition and rhythm recognition. And we work on these problems with my colleagues. Besides the poetic corpus of the national corpus, there is a small group of verse theorists who work with computational stikhovedenie, as we try to call it. It consists, the linguist Sergei Starostin, whom I mentioned today, and the verse theorist Maxim Shapir, who died, unfortunately, in 2006, were among the initiators of this project, which we now continue together with Sergei Starostin, some Anatoly, and other programmers, programmists, and verse theorists. So this is another important tendency. The third important tendency is correlation between traditional libraries and digital libraries. So we can see that traditional libraries in different parts of the globe incorporate electronic edition into the catalog. So if you look for Bibliothèque Nationale de France and go to the catalog, which is the digital version of the old book catalog, and now we can see that Gallica is incorporated in the catalog, and you can in the catalog you can see the results. Well, you can see the actual book in the store and its electronic edition if it is available. Now the practical aspect, how all this can be actually implemented and realized in Russia. So from this point of view, my prophecy is rather, you know, negative. Well, many of these projects will develop slower than they could, first of all, because of the chaotic reforms that take place in many spheres in Russia today, the reform of the academy, the reform of higher education, the reform of the library system. Well, in the last few years, it simply led to to the increase in chaos rather than increase in efficiency, which is the aim of these reforms. So it's very difficult to predict now what happens with any project in the nearest future. Well, but, the positive thing is that it is internet, and you cannot simply, you know, lock it. And also, it is important that these projects do not belong to a particular institution. So, FabWeb does not belong to any institute or the academy or any particular participant in the project. So, these are, you know, kind of joint projects with many participants, and it is impossible to just close it. So, we will survive as we survived at the start. When we started to work with this project, but I cannot say, for instance, when the second version of FabWeb will be fully available to the users. Well, I can show you where it is actually situated. I mean, the model itself. It's Feb 2 at GNPBU. GNPBU is the pedagogical library, the main library of the Russian Academy of Education. And this is the place where the Feb laboratory worked for the last 5 or 6 years. But in January, the library and the Academy of Education in general simply suspended all digital projects, including the new digital library of the Russian Academy of Education created by the FabWeb team. And the laboratory simply, I can say, left the library. Well, they were fired, and all the project stopped. So now, FabWeb 2, it's nowhere. This particular site does not belong to us anymore. Well, by courtesy of the library, we still exist.